You're listening to the Around Comics Book Club episode, Saga of the Swamp Thing, sponsored by InStockTrades.com.
Chicago, this is Around Comics, the comic culture podcast, where each week our revolving panel of guests talk about everything in and around the world of comic books and comics culture.
Comics.
And Around Comics is recorded at Dark Tower Comics and Collectibles, located at 4835 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. If you are in the area, drop on by. Hey there, folks. Christopher Niesman here, and this is a different kind of episode for us. It is not one of our regular weekly episodes. I lied to you.
You son of a bitch.
This is one of our book club episodes, and we are talking about Alan Moore's Saga of the Swamp Thing, Volume 1.
Saga of the Swamp Thing.
God, it's like Sean Connery does Alan Moore by Sal.
I like swamps.
About every month or 6 weeks or so, we pick a book
and then we
go home and we read it, and then we come back and we talk about it, and that's what this episode is. And this one was picked by
and this book.
One. It's getting later in the night here. I'm slowing down. This book was selected by our very own Brian Salazar. So
hey.
Sal,
yes.
why don't you kick things off tell us a little bit of why you picked this. This was discounted a tremendous 47% off the cover price at InStockTrades.com. If you would like to go and pick this up, I think that you can still grab this for 47% off if you run to your computer right now. And thank you for InStock Trades for sponsoring our book club selection. And we will have a new selection at the end of this episode. So stick around for details for that. So Sal, why Saga of the Swamp Thing?
Well, I picked it because one, it just came out.
Yeah.
it hadn't been released in this format in a big collected hardcover thing. So, and I hadn't read it before. I didn't read it when it first came out.
You never read?
I had never. It was
not even in trade.
I had never read more Swamp Thing.
God, you're a more junkie too.
I know, and it's really like the only work of his that not the only thing I haven't ever read, but it was one of the major ones that I had never read. And I really am kind of glad that I hadn't read it like when it first came out, or even, you know, when I was younger, because I don't think I would have really appreciated it for what it was.
And
at
this
that
collection
time.
Is pretty.
Yes, it's very nice. Very nice collection, hardcover collection. It's
nice
on the
paper.
It's on the nice paper that I like, the sort of newsprint almost replica newsprint kind of stuff. But if I'm remembering my facts correctly, this was Alan Moore's first work for DC.
I believe it was his first American work.
Yeah. He had done stuff
Marvel UK
and 2000 AD and all that kind of stuff, and this was his first work that they had seen him over there doing that stuff and decided, well, maybe he could do this.
Kid's got some chops.
Kid's got some some talent we could maybe exploit. And and I gotta say, man, you know, thinking about it, reading it, and sort of thinking about it in context of when it came out, it was like 84
or something like that.
Not even a little late. 87, I thought.
Oh, it was earlier 80s.
Anyway,
pre-crisis.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah, because Swamp Thing shows up during the crisis. There's eventually a tie-in issue with the
1982. And thinking of it as you know, Alan Moore's first work for, you know, this major comic book company, it's like the dude had some balls.
Oh yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And to come out with this and really sort of swing for the fences and take a character that you know, in reality is like, you know, sort of a nothing, not a nothing character, but sort of, you know, a secondary, weird little horror trope and kind of a strange character. And just completely in the first issue, dismantle anything you possibly would have thought Swamp Thing was.
But did it in an incredibly creative and respectful way. I mean, he was coming onto this book, and there were two guys that created Swamp Thing. That, I mean, these are not, you know, just fly by night creators. Yeah. Len Wein and Bernie Wrightson.
Right.
I mean, that's pretty
honestly, company to keep. I didn't know that Swamp Thing, its origin was like 1972.
Yeah, it'd been around for a long time.
Yeah, 10 years.
And so yeah, for him to come in and just sort of, you know, I mean, completely redesign the character, basically.
Yeah, if you're not familiar, what he did was Swamp Thing previously had been like, oh, Alec Holland was turned into a swamp monster.
Right. In an explosion, he was a biochemist or a biologist, something like that.
Yeah, and Moore pretty much said, no, it's a thing that thought it was Alec Holland. He was just a plant creature that was created.
He was a plant creature that thought it had the memories of Alec Holland and thought that it was him, and in reality it's not. It's this plant creature. And really, very quickly, you know, takes it apart and puts it back together and you know, the issue that, you know,
in his first issue, he killed Swamp Thing.
Yeah, he kills the swamp. He kills the creature off.
You know,
and then
number 20 is that first issue in this one, mm-hmm. and at the end of it, that was written by Len Wein, and they shoot him at the end, and it's like, oh, he's dead. And
right.
The first one in this is Len Wein.
Yeah, it's a Len Wein anatomy lesson is the first Alan Moore. So it's like the setup. Wein sets it up for Moore to like be like.
This is written by Alan Moore.
Written by
issue
Alan Moore.
20 is.
Oh, is
Alan
it?
Moore. Yeah.
Yes. Len Wein had something to do with it.
He was the editor.
Oh, okay,
yeah,
he was the editor.
Okay. Yeah.
So, well, you know, at least they were pretty conscious to let Len Wein kind of help put a bow on the story that he and I believe if
you read the foreword by Len Wein, mm-hmm. the foreword in this collection is by him. He talks about sort of the evolution of it from the very beginning of it, and then it sort of went away, and then he was doing other stuff, and then they had the idea of bringing the character back, and I think Len actually picked Alan Moore. He was involved in picking Alan Moore to bring him back and write it and everything. So after the first 19 issues or whatever that they had done, but another
thing that people may want to be aware of, or maybe didn't even know, that these were DC proper. This was there was no Vertigo whenever this was written, and it's been folded into Vertigo. You know, after it was already published, this Swamp Thing kind of spawned Vertigo. In a lot of ways.
I mean, you had John Constantine showed up in Spawn, and that's where he, you know, first came from. Alan Moore created that character, and it took off from there. And I mean, because it really didn't fit in. I mean, later in this collection, you see characters like the Demon and the Justice League.
Yeah.
And it's very weird to me. It was very strange to get to that, and all of a sudden, the Justice League pops up in this book. And
later, Batman shows up, not in this collection, but Batman will show up.
And it's very strange, almost, because I guess going at it from
backwards.
Backwards. It's like, oh, it's just weird to see that happen.
It's a Vertigo book.
Yeah, basically. But if you don't know about the Swamp Thing at all, like Tom said, it originally it was a character that sort of a very comic book origin of a scientist who there was an explosion and he's turned into this creature.
What would have happened to the Flash if he was in a swamp?
Yeah. So he turns into the Swamp Thing, but Alan Moore retcons that and says no, he's not, he's a plant, he's this living plant for whatever reason, and
I thought that was brilliant, that it was not the idea of the chemicals affecting the man and then mixing with the plants. It took the man kind of out of the equation. It was the chemicals affected the plants and they absorbed his consciousness.
Right.
And I thought that was what a brilliant way to reinvent that character.
But like Tom said, in the first issue, they shoot and kill him. And he is then collected up by this guy, this corporation, basically.
Industrialist.
Industrialist. And he puts him in cold storage to examine him or whatever. And he That's the second issue, the anatomy lesson, which everybody always talks about that issue, and it's a phenomenal issue.
That's a great Saul Bass.
Yes, the mm-hmm. sort of logo of that issue. And this is probably my second favorite issue in the book, but the industrious, and I can't remember his name, the guy that captures the Swamp Thing or whatever, he hires a character called the Floronic Man, who is also a botanist or biologist or whatever the fuck, but he also happens to be, and was, do you know, Tom, was he a character? He was a character before this, right?
Jason Woodrow,
he was the Floronic Man before this, so yep. He brings in this character to sort of study the Swamp Thing, and as we find out later on, Woodrow is fascinated by the Swamp Thing, and he's a sort of plant-based
villain. Yeah, well, it's like Swamp Thing is sort of like the pinnacle of what Woodrow wants
to be. He wants to leave his humanity behind, and it's really an interesting, throughout the first, I don't know, five or six issues of this, maybe even seven, you have this sort of paradox between Swamp Thing coming to terms with the fact that he has no humanity, that he's not human, he never was human, and then you have the Floronic Man who on the opposite side of it is trying to get rid of his humanity and become what the Swamp Thing is, which is a plant god kind of, or the, you know, in touch with what Alan Moore comes up with is the green, which is sort of, I don't know, nature.
Yep.
You know, whatever, the earth, the planet, all that the kind green. Of stuff. Yeah, the green. And so you sort of follow these two things along, these two characters along. In the second issue, the Floronic Man decides to sort of backstab his employer, and accidentally he releases the Swamp Thing because everyone thinks he's dead, but he's not. He's just frozen. He's cold. If you can't kill him because he's not alive technically. But in fucking over his boss, basically he accidentally defrosts the Swamp Thing and lets him go. This issue is just a beautiful homage to sort of, you know, old time horror stories. I mean, it's set up with, you know, precision of that twist ending of how the Woodrow, you know, is telling you this whole story as you're going along. He's narrating the issue of him being hired, and it has a very Hitchcock feel to it, where, you know, he's the whole time, you know, he's gonna, you know, what he's gonna do, and he's just sort of telling you what's going on or what happened before this moment that he basically kills this industrialist. Almost accidentally, but and it's just a phenomenally written issue, and once again from a guy that, you know, hadn't really done that much up until that point in comics, and to come in, you know, and do that his second issue ever for DC is just so impressive.
I mean, it's a modern classic, you know. As it was written. I also love the title of the first issue. It was called Loose Ends.
Loose Ends.
And then tie it up.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. You talked about Swamp Thing and realizing that he wasn't human, and as the story goes on, we start to learn that being human maybe isn't as important as your humanity, and Woodrue or the Floronic Man is trying to completely abandon his humanity. He wants to join the green.
Right.
And then we see that overlap and flip back at the end of the story where Swamp Thing finds that he does have a place in the world and kind of in a weird way kind of rediscovers his humanity that way, where the Floronic Man,
well, it comes to terms at the end, with his his existence.
Yeah, his place.
His existence, yeah.
And where the Floronic Man is at the very end, he's grasping desperately to get his humanity back. And
or the pretense of it.
The pretense,
of his humanity to save his own sort of skin.
And it becomes, and skin is a huge theme in this with him. And he really just kind of turns into a character that's pitied by the Justice League.
Yeah, there's that scene of Superman putting his cape on around his shoulders and they're walking him off. But going back to this, the anatomy lesson, which I think is just a perfectly titled issue, because in it you have more dissecting, who the Swamp Thing is, what he is. And this is where he retcons, you know, the origin of the Swamp Thing, and you find out that he's not Alec Holland. And he's a plant. He's a, you know, he's purely a plant. He's got, he does this great thing of like, Woodrow's examining him. He's doing
an autopsy,
on the Swamp Thing. And as he's learning things, you're learning things of like, he's got lungs, but they're not real lungs. They're made out of fibers, plant fibers and stuff like that. They couldn't actually function. His heart isn't real. Yeah. It's all this sort of,
it's kind of like building a person out of Legos.
It's an affectation.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's an affectation of what humanity is. It's what the plant thought he was.
They're supposed to be a
brain. They're supposed to be. And he goes through all these things and shows us. And at the same time, Moore is dissecting the mythology of the Swamp Thing and saying, yeah, it's not, he's not what you thought he was anymore. He's something else. He's something different. So that's why it's just a phenomenal issue.
I love the revelation whenever they exhume his wife's body, because they're trying to find out what the chemicals did to that turned him into the Swamp Thing. And so they exhume her body
because she was there and around the chemicals. They assume that there would be something, you know, affecting her, and that's you realize.
It's like, wait, it didn't affect
tissue.
Him.
It doesn't affect.
Had nothing to do with
it.
Him.
Couldn't affect human tissue. It couldn't affect it. Yeah,
it affected the plants.
Right.
Yeah.
Another thing in this issue was then once the Swamp Thing wakes up, and he kills this industrialist, and he gets out and everything. The next issue is a lot of these dream sequences. The Swamp Thing is sort of, he's pulled back from reality, and he has gone back to the swamp now, and he's become a plant. I mean, he's solely a plant.
He's rooted in himself.
There's this phenomenal full page spread of him in the swamp, just grown into the rest of the plants there, and it's just gorgeous the artist, I can't think of the artist's name now.
Oh, Steve Bissette.
Did, and I was actually talking to Tom about this, is like, I got the feeling in reading this that Bissette really liked drawing Swamp Thing, not so much everybody else.
Yeah.
He kind of rushed through everybody else a little bit here and there. Swamp Thing, though, man, he took his time on a lot of pages of Swamp Thing.
This has some of my maybe least favorite pages and most favorite pages, you know, in a book. It's like, and then, Todelman was the anchor, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, there's these great scenes of the Swamp Thing, you know, in the earth and just, you know, meshing with the rest of the plant life and basically, you know, just
it's
pulling away from
humanity.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, he just looks like a mound of growth,
like,
swamp and moss and
Pirates of the Caribbean. Whenever they would like grow the ship, that's
right,
kind of what
right.
it reminds
yeah,
me of.
Yeah. And as the story goes, we're finding more about Woodrow. He's now obsessed with the Swamp Thing.
Woodrow.
Sorry.
Yeah. It was Woodrow, but he changed his name to Woodrow. You know, rue the vegetation.
And he's now sort of like camped out in the swamp, and he's still trying to examine the Swamp Thing and figure out how to become more like him, and he's assuming that he can somehow use this for his own advantage, for his, you know, to turn into, you know, what he wants to be. But at the same time, you're dealing with these dream sequences of what the Swamp Thing is going through, you know, I guess, you know, just sort of his dreams, or since he's not human, he's not, you know, it's hard to say
I think he's completely,
but it's memories, and,
well,
he's
completely detached himself from his humanity, and he's being absorbed into the earth, and it is almost kind of like this acid dream of
but I thought they were really effective. I thought a lot of times dream sequences to me don't work all that well. They seem to be too
dreamy.
Like too abstract or
ethereal.
Yeah, you know, they don't actually they let you guess. Yeah, they don't tell a story very effectively. Where I thought these did both. It gave you the atmosphere that it didn't come out and say anything very on the nose, but at the same time you got a clear understanding of the, you know, how he's trying to, his mind is trying to accept the idea that he's not human, and he's sort of going through his history, but it's not really his history. It, you know, it's blended with, you know, weird psychedelic and you know, astral sort of things.
Tubers.
Yeah, tubers. Yeah, he weird grows tubers, these weird man. Tubers.
Psychedelic tubers.
I love the, kind of going back to whenever he at the beginning when he had rooted himself and Abby and Matt, right? They find him in the swamp. And it's not like Swamp Thing was like a handsome, strapping man before this happened. Right. He was always Swamp Thing. He was always this swamp creature. But it's gone to a new level, and Abby is horrified because there are bugs crawling in and out of his body, and it's,
well, she still sees him as human. As she a man, thinks yeah. him as a deformed man or something, and
he's got stuff crawling in him,
but he's not. Yeah. You know, it's, and that's, you know, another effective tool by Moore of you know, telling us that he's not human anymore. He's not once we're, and yeah, Abby, because I haven't read the first 19 issues of this, mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, Abby is just that character that I don't know how is she, you know, what's the relationship between them? Do you guys know?
I don't remember off the top of my head.
But she's just sort of the, I got the feeling that initially she was just sort of that trope of, you know, the damsel in distress.
Yeah.
But as this story progresses, it becomes a sort of strange. She has a fascination with Swamp Thing, and she finds...
It gets stranger.
Yes, it gets stranger and stranger. And she finds, like, the humanity in him that she can't find in Matt, her own...
I mean, there's really... You feel that there is a romance between the two of them in a lot of ways.
There's a lot of frolicking and walking in the swamp and playing in the water and that kind of stuff between them, and even between other characters. So I don't think I've ever read a book where there's more of the main character just like walking in swamp, you know, it's like nothing else just going on, just like him walking. But for some reason it fits, because it gives it that it gives it a certain tone to it.
But it's sort of like he's not in a rush to do anything. Like
this
whole
thing
is like he. It's part of the whole dropping the illusion of being human is that he kind of loses track of
that
time.
That sense of time, yeah.
Like
that,
in a way.
The
like
concept of it,
it doesn't matter. He could just sit there forever.
Forever. Yeah. He's timeless, yeah. No, that's exactly right.
You know, I love, you know, just the whole atmosphere of the swamp. And if you look at a swamp, it's it is absolutely alive. That there is every square inch of a swamp has life on it or in it, you know, from the microbiological level to the huge trees. But it's mysterious and it's extremely atmospheric. And I think that Moore and Bissette use that to such great effect in this, that it there are creepy moments that are that are framed by the swamp, but there are these moments of, you know, extreme livelihood and brightness
and beauty and.
Yeah, but it's always with this backdrop of mystery to it, and what might just be below the surface.
Sure,
well, Swamp Thing could have like flowers bloom from him, you know, when he chooses to. You know, like it's not like it doesn't have to be like gross swamp,
right?
You know,
right.
Like that's not the only limitation to.
Well, I like the one part later on where the seasons are changing, and, mm-hmm. and Abby's like, are you changing color? And he's like, yeah, it's, you know, autumn's coming. So, you know, he's just sort of in tune color. And she sort of laughs it off. But yeah, I mean, she still, even by the end of this, she doesn't really accept
him. It's still Alec. She
still calls him Alec. He's still human to some degree or whatever. And he, you know, by the end of this, he's, you know, I mean, that's sort of the climax of this collection is him coming to complete terms.
There is no Alec.
Yeah. But as we were going on in this issue, in particular, Woodrue at this point has, through some sort of experiment with parts of the Swamp Thing, he's now connected to the green, or sort of infected it, and he feels in touch with all of the world and. I thought it was kind of a neat way for Alan Moore to tell us or give us some insight as to what the Swamp Thing is like, yeah, or what his abilities are, or you know what he can do without having him actually do it.
And if you're familiar with Animal Man, that same concept extends to
right.
how was it Morrison sort of took a lot of that with how.
Yeah. I thought about Animal Man a lot reading
of
this.
Of how Animal Man relates to the world around him.
It's like a unified field.
Very much took a lot from how Moore visualized Swamp Thing reacting to the rest of the world around him. So if you're familiar with Animal Man, it's the same. Mm-hmm. That's where a lot of those, I feel very much, I mean, they call it the red.
You know? Right.
I mean, it's not like Morrison isn't saying that it came from this, but yeah, right. if you're familiar with that idea, that's very much
the same.
One of the kind of weird and kind of moments was when Woodrow is eating the
psychedelic tubers, man.
Does that have anything to do with his evolving powers? Is that he's actually consuming part of the Swamp Thing?
Well, Swamp Thing has a thing, and it comes up later, that he can grow... Anyone who eats these tubers has, like, a psychedelic
trip.
Right. Like, Abby does it at some point.
Some sort of connection to the green.
That's fucking weird,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, he can grow a tuber.
Well, it's like mushrooms, or you know.
I'm not going to spoil any further part, but it becomes a thing where, like, you can eat a tuber off a Swamp Thing. Take a trip with him.
That's
know,
pretty like, fun.
God, that's fucking wild.
One of the things I did think about when reading this is Woodrow, and like thinking about him as a character, and like what it would be like to want to be a plant as opposed to a human so badly, and like thinking like why he wants that, why does he want that.
I think it's funny because his vision of, like, it's like the thing of, like, oh, you won't have, like, pain or any of that stuff. But it's funny because so much of what Swamp Thing goes through is, like, recapturing all of, like, the idea of, like, forming relationships with people and, like, the things that I think Woodrow wants to avoid or, like, separate himself from, even though it has nothing to do. It turns out it has nothing to do with what you are.
I think it was more
are.
Of a hatred of humanity. And that's how that came. He hated humanity so much that he wanted to be on the other side.
For whatever reason, he looked at it as, like plants were cold and scientific.
Yeah,
and there, you know, like if he could live like that, he would leave the pain of his humanity behind. But then, you know,
everything like Swamp Thing does is the opposite.
The opposite, yeah. These two characters are the exact opposites of one another, even though they're so closely intertwined. But I don't know. I was just sort of fascinated by the Floronic Man and Moore's ability to take this sort of two bit.
Yeah.
You know, villain and turn him into a
the whole thing
really
with Swamp Thing is that everything is so vibrant with him, and like he's more
in tune.
Once he accepts it, what he is, he's more alive than he was before.
Yeah.
Like in all the ways that Woodrow wants to avoid. Woodrow doesn't want any of this stuff, probably, that Swamp Thing is able to experience. Woodrow thinks that having access to it will give him power or manipulation, but that's not how
it works.
Swamp Thing looks at it, how it works, or how.
At the end of this issue, he does become in touch with the green, and I thought it was kind of neat or kind of interesting that he sort of, and they didn't really ever answer this, but like Woodrow feels like the green tells him what to do, like he has to go and destroy humanity, but it seems by the end of it that it wasn't really the green telling him that; it was just him wanting that and using the green to get his own way, kind of thing.
Like a religious fanatic.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah. Where
God told me to do it.
Right.
So I'm serious.
But there is a connection. He does have a connection to the green, and we see later on that he, you know, that they are, you know, the green, whatever it is using him, is powering him, you know, is helping him accomplish these goals. So I thought that was kind of interesting. That
I think
Is it Woodrow? Is it the Green? Is it a combination of both? Who's?
But you could kind of look at the Green as a character in and of itself. Of
right.
Like, there's different facets to what it's, you know, like the idea of like if people weren't around, plants would just overgrow everything.
Right.
You know, that that sort of thing exists. That's
a reality, yeah.
That's a reality, you know, in the world. And it sort of exists within Swamp Thing and sort of exists within Woodru, but Woodru is such, you know, he's got his... He wants to overgrow everything because he wants to... He hates humanity.
Humanity,
yeah,
so
I mean,
badly.
Like,
yeah.
I just always thought of it as kind of like it's all about like the Swamp Thing is more. It's tough to say because the nature of what the green is. It's like this weird passive but not passive. Mm-hmm. Type thing.
Well, it's like it's passive because it doesn't have a choice. But now that Woodrow's sort of infected it,
it becomes
aggressive. Yeah, it has an outlet for it.
Maybe
know.
Another way to look at it is that Woodrow was in touch with the green, but was still partly human. He hadn't, you know, his self had not completely surrendered to the green or been taken over by it. So you have all of this input from the green, but you still have the aggressive human nature that Woodrow could never get rid of.
Yeah.
And so it was this misdirected use of this
power.
No,
that's
power,
yeah, that's
you know?
Probably a good analogy of it. Next issue is more Swamp Thing. And we're still dealing with the Swamp Thing trying to figure out what the fuck he is or who he is or, you know, that kind of thing. And then he comes in contact with Woodrue's red mass that's infected the green, and he doesn't know what it is, but he's starting to figure it out. And it, you know, Woodrue once again now is the catalyst of bringing Swamp Thing out of this, you know, this coma that he's kind of putting himself in. And
is this the issue where we're really introduced to the concept of red and green, of what the green is and what the red is or could be?
He doesn't get into it in much detail. He gives you sort of just an over, you know, it's sort of like as you're reading it, you're reading it from the perspective of either Woodrue or Swamp Thing. So a lot of it's just assumed. They know what it is. It's because it's sort of inherent in what they are, but they never, you know, it never like sits down and just says, this is what it is. This is sort of the issue where that concept is.
Where red is humanity and industrialization.
And aggressiveness and all that stuff. And that plays out a lot. And as this issue progresses, Woodrue is going on his campaign of basically destroying humanity. You know, he's making all, you know, plant life just overgrow everything and attack, and you know, he's takes over a town basically and covers all the buildings in
that was fucking creepy.
Yeah.
And the whole scene where, you know, the town folk go into their houses and there's even a narration box that says and most of them were more than happy to do it because they thought they would be safer in their houses.
Right.
And they, you know, did know that he was sending them to their death, and he grows this vegetation over their houses and basically floods the houses with oxygen.
Right.
Over oxygenates them.
And then it's a spark, it's a lighter, it's a, you know, anything, and the houses start to blow up because of oxygen. And the concept is that if they do nothing but, you know, if all the plants in the world just produce oxygen, it will kill off all of humanity. We can't live.
Not just humanity, all animal life.
All animal life. You're right. It's all animal life, and there'll be nothing left but plants. So that's Woodrue's goal, and he starts this town.
It's like being in one big-ass Vegas casino. We're just going to pump it so full of oxygen.
No. And in this issue, we have Abby, who's now freaking out because this stuff's happening, and she goes running back to the swamp looking for the Swamp Thing, but he's still in his, you know, vegetative state.
Rooted.
You know? And, but it is her that sort of helps bring him out of it, as well as his coming to grips with things. But it's really her in danger that touches on his false humanity again, or you know, whatever.
Well, it kind of becomes apparent that she is his tether to humanity. She is that one string that keeps him connected.
Well, and I think it's just I think it's almost reflex too. It's like he hasn't to this point dropped all the pretense of that he was human. It's still there.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it's still inside him somewhere. And so it's sort of reaction when she's in danger that he's going to save her. I mean, and so he busts out of this rooted state. And this is the where we see the scene where she, you know, she looks at him a bit differently because he's, you know, he's much more overgrown now and mm-hmm. and even more monstrous looking. But and she asks, you know, Alec, and he says, no, not Alec, and he walks off. And so this is the first time that, you know, he's stated that he's not Alec anymore. He's not human.
He's pissed right now.
And he's very pissed. Yeah, he's very pissed about what Woodrue's doing. So he goes marching off in search of him. And in the meantime, Woodrue's just like terrorizing townsfolk and killing people. And
we actually started to get a good explanation when Swamp Thing finally confronts him. You know, where he's like, "This isn't the way of the wilderness."
Right.
As we get in the next issue, and he's like,
he shows him,
if you kill all the humans, who is going to convert all the oxygen back to what we need? You know,
it's a symbiotic relationship. Yeah. We need each of us.
And Woodrue starts crying like a little bitch.
And that's the point where he doesn't only explain it to Woodrue, but it's like he explains it to the Green.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Green pulls away from Woodrue, and now he's lost his connection. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he just starts freaking out and crying
I think that is the theme.
And the Justice League shows up.
Then they don't show up yet. The next issue, they sit around the whatever the hell
satellite.
And
how many feet above the Earth?
I don't know.
Tom, you should know.
10,000
off the top of my head. You should know something.
That. Yeah. Well, in the next issue, we have Woodrow's actions are being broadcast in the Justice League, and their satellite pick it up, and they basically spend the entire issue discussing what they can't do and how they can't really do anything to fight this guy. They don't know what to do. And I really, two things I like about it. One, I just like the idea of, in this sort of situation, the Justice League is powerless.
Are they going to go punch the earth?
Yeah, exactly. They don't know what, you know, but the other thing I really like is Moore's take on Superman. He writes him much smarter than most people write Superman, much more intelligent,
and
kind of a dick.
Don't you know you could do, like, when Firestorm is like, can't I just turn it all into this? And he's like, well, do you know how many oxygen molecules are there? Because I could count them if you want. You know, it's like an edge of dickishness.
It's a little Brainiac 2.
A little bit. So I thought, I just kind of like that. But so we see the Justice League just sort of stand around and discuss how they are going to be ineffective.
There was the very Denny O'Neill Green Arrow comment of, you know, we're there to take care of Manhattan and Metropolis.
Who's going
to
take care of LaCroix,
Louisiana. Yeah. It's like, wow, Denny O'Neill write that?
At the same time, Swamp Thing confronts Woodrue and like Tom said, you know, he explains to him and the Green that this isn't the way, you know, this isn't going to work. This isn't a solution. This isn't, it's going to be the downfall of everything. So Woodrue, you know, basically just wanders back off into the swamp powerless, and everything kind of goes back to normal. I did like the chainsaw, the whole chainsaw thing where, like, some guy attacks Woodrue with a chainsaw, and then Woodrue picks it up and he sort of talks about how the chainsaw, you know, is used to cut down trees all the time, so it's very symbolic that he's going to start cutting people down, you know, with it. And
well, I think that gets back to, you know, here he is, this plant creature that is using a human weapon, and it just kind of underscores that, you know, it is that aggressive human nature of his. But, you know, I think that,
you know what, why you bring that up, one of the other things I kind of thought about is, like, is Woodrue sort of a commentary on environmentalists to some degree? You know, I almost saw him as, like, people who think they know what's best for
people who think
nature
that,
or
people
the
who
planet.
Think that, like, we're committing our existence as a crime.
Right. Yeah. And but, you know, they use it as an excuse for their own sort of, you know.
I could see that.
A little bit. I don't know. I just kind of got that feeling a little bit.
I could see that, definitely.
Well, you know, it's working in extremes. And I really feel like the theme of this first story is that there has to be a balance between man and
nature.
And, you know, it was the, yes, we produce the carbon dioxide that plants breathe and they give us the oxygen. And without the two, neither one can live. And I really felt like that was the theme of this first arc.
Yeah, and that's sort of what Swamp, you know, Swamp Thing is, this sort of perfect blend. Yeah. He's the purest humanity because it's only like an idealized view, because it's not real. It's just what he, you know, like remembers of humanity. And then, you know, he's a plant, so he is that perfect balance, kind of. So
plant
man,
Swamp Thing.
You just love saying that.
Swamp thing. Then you have the great, you know, yeah. At the end of the issue, Woodrow goes back to his little swamp
hut
ship thing that he's built, and the Green Lantern and Superman show up when everything's done and they haven't done anything, and he's trying to put his skin back on. But he uses this paint.
What is the
latex?
It's flexi skin or what?
Yeah, some, I don't know what the
skin in a can.
It's skin in a can.
Very fucking Ron Popeil.
But at this point, he's become so deformed and he can't cover up. He used to be able to cover up and look human, and now he can. And Superman and Green Lantern just sort of take pity on him, and they just usher him off. And
did they even say Arkham? Like question mark?
Yeah.
And that showed that plays into a later story.
Oh, does it?
Floronic Man shows up again.
Oh, and there is my favorite page in this collection.
The Swamp Thing. I think this was done on the cover of, or redone for the cover of one of the trades that came out. It's him in the swamp with the sun behind him and his arms raised up. Like I said, I mean, there's panels in here with Bissette drawing the Swamp Thing, which is just gorgeous.
Amazing
detail. And then he draws
Firestorm's face.
Yeah, exactly.
Not so much detail.
Yeah, you can tell what he likes to draw and what he doesn't.
That is an absolutely beautiful page.
Yes, it is.
The end of this story arc is Swamp Thing kind of comes to grips with everything, and you can, he just looks at one with the world, and it's a very powerful page.
Yeah, he's beautiful. At this point, he's basically come to grips with, you know, that he's not human, but there's a certain humanity instilled in him, and yeah, you get the feeling that he's a much more powerful character than he once was because of his. And I don't mean powerful in the sense of like,
there's nothing holding him back now. He doesn't have to try and reclaim or look for a cure.
Right.
He is what he is.
Yeah, and he can move forward. And that's, you know, Moore's entire goal of this, you know, these first five or six issues was,
okay. He's free now.
Yeah. And I thought this first story arc was great, but it didn't end there. The collection doesn't end there. And then it goes into the next story arc, which the next issue is probably my favorite issue.
That's fucking creepy, dude.
Oh, it's extremely creepy.
This is where it becomes a horror book again.
Yes. I absolutely love this issue. It's basically about this little demon creature called the Monkey King, who has... and I love this concept, and this could be a story all on its own, but this demon has basically tricked this couple into using a Ouija board and spelling out whatever spell to release him. And then he goes on and kills the family, which then triggers this whole series of events. And this all happened in the past, and we're told this sort of in flashbacks. Mm-hmm. But the family's killed, and except for their son, who they say is autistic, but I don't know if he was before, or they just assume he is autistic after this happens because of the tragedy. I don't know. But the son's put into this home for troubled youth, and Abby is going to work at that home. And so this whole series of events happens, but in the beginning of the book, you have this character.
This traveler,
mysterious traveler shows up in town, and he does this fucking freaky, creepy shit. Where he runs into characters and basically tells them that, you know, when they're going to die. And it could be in 3 hours, you know, it could be 30 years or whatever. But, you know, there's a series of him running into characters and basically telling them their futures. And they're not good futures.
Yeah.
And as you go through the story, you realize that all this stuff is intertwined. All these events are intertwined in time. And he seems to know it all. And you're not sure about him in the beginning. At first, I didn't know who he was. I didn't realize who he was. And I wasn't sure if he was a good guy, a bad guy, or what the hell he was.
You definitely get the feeling that he's a bad guy.
Yeah, so, you feel,
I'm coming and hell's coming with me.
There's even a passage where it says when he's checking into a hotel and it says the devil checked in at noon. Yeah. So you assume he's an evil character. And as the story progresses, Abby is playing in the swamp. She's frolicking in the swamp, playing Jaws with Swamp Thing as
this
he pulls
is a very
her into the
frolicky scene.
Yes, it's a very frolicky scene. But as we find out, she goes to work at this school or this this home where this boy whose parents were killed,
Paul,
in the past. And he's an autistic kid and. Right off the bat, you know, Moore sets up this kind of creepy, weird, you know, just like I don't think I could ever work in a place like this. I would have a hard time dealing with it. For one, especially kids, it was just, you know, like the idea that a kid is sort of, I don't want to say out of control, but unpredictable like that, like these kids are, and sometimes dangerous. It's, you know, an adult's one thing, but a kid, it's like, what do you do? You know, what if you're in a situation where a kid
they're innocent and defenseless, right. but
at the same time, it could pull a butcher knife on you and hack you to death. You know, it's like, and it's like, so he's, and these kids are tormented by the Monkey King, and
I really felt like this this story was incredibly influenced by The Exorcist.
With the character at the beginning, Paul, and there's even blood.
I mean, I guess this is spoilerific. Obviously.
It's Jason Blood, the demon Etrigan.
There's even a panel as he's flip back a couple pages where he's checking into the hotel.
Oh, with Jason Blood.
Yeah, I mean, right there at the very bottom. That's almost like a scene out of The Exorcist.
Yeah, the house a little bit. Yeah, I can see that.
With the suitcases.
JB.
But yeah, he introduces Paul, and Paul's got this weird thing about spelling, which I thought was really fascinating, sort of a double entendre. I kept saying, if you don't spell correctly, the Monkey King will come for you. And when I first read it, I was like, is he talking about spelling a word or spells like magic? Yeah. And it's both, you know. But, you know, he shows these pictures that this kid's been drawing, these really fucked up pictures of people getting hacked up and torn apart by the Monkey King. And
Abby's like,
seen the Monkey King sound?
No, I haven't run into the Monkey King.
He's in the Monkey King.
Abby's like, she's like, I don't know if I can do this.
Yeah, I mean, I very much felt I was very empathetic of her at that time because it was like I would have a hard time dealing, you know, in that situation. It would be, you know, difficult. But and then at the same time, you have Abby dealing with Matt, who we haven't really talked about at this point. And I'm assuming this was sort of set up earlier in the series, but Matt, her boyfriend or husband, seems to have some strange powers, magical that seem to be sort of corrupting his mind, and he's very jealous of the time that Abby spends with Alec and just away from him, and he conjures up these manifestations of her doing very naughty things for him, and he's just, as the story goes on, he's getting worse and worse and creepier and creepier. And
he's the ultimate jealous husband who, instead of, you know, going to the whorehouse, he's making his own.
Yeah, he's conjuring his own whores. So that story is going on at the same time, and their relationship is getting tenser and tenser. And she's running off. Every time they get in a fight, she runs off to the swamp. Eat some tubers and chill.
I'm gonna go frolic.
Thing. And then as the story progresses a little bit, we find out that the Monkey King is this demon and the whole Ouija board thing, which, like I said, the whole idea that a demon uses a Ouija board to trick people into releasing him is just awesome. That is a fucking awesome, brilliant idea.
Can I use those Ouija boards?
Oh, it's just, I mean, I could just see a movie, a whole, you know, series of shit, but
I think there was a movie called Ouija Board.
Was there probably?
Don't play it alone.
But the Monkey King.
Don't play it alone.
Have you guys ever messed with the Ouija board?
Oh, yeah. They're pretty
fun. Wasn't
much else to do in Southern Illinois.
Yeah, well. They are freaky. If you're, like, you know, when you're 15 and fucking around with a Ouija board with your friends and They could freak you out. But the Monkey King, we find out, is this demon that, for whatever reason, and I never got a clear understanding of it, but for whatever reason, he's latched on to Alec. Or not Alec, Paul. The kid. And
because the Monkey King needs a master. He has to, I guess, have a human master for him to stay in this plane, realm? Is how I'm understanding.
Okay.
He has to have... He's almost like a parasite, I guess, is that he has...
And he lives off of fear. He's in this home, and he's sucking all the... or living off all the fear that these kids have in them.
And actually manifesting fear in them and growing in them. But I believe that Paul is his connection to this plane. And,
okay.
Because he keeps saying that the Monkey King has to have a master.
Right. Then we see like these weird events that were talked about in the earlier in the book that Jason Blood sort of alluded to come to fruition. People being speared by a swordfish and these bizarre things. And we find out by the end of the issue, we find out that. Oh no, we don't actually. We don't find out yet who Jason Blood is. If you don't know, I didn't know.
It's at the very end. It's the cliffhanger.
It?
Yeah. It's
no, not this issue. It's the next issue.
Are you sure?
Yeah, you know who Jason? I mean,
if you know, I didn't know who Jason Blood was. I didn't realize.
Okay.
I probably did it one time. I just didn't know while I was reading this that he's the demon Etrigan. I didn't know that. Yeah. So I'm like, I still up until the end of this issue, I didn't know that was him. I still didn't know who this guy was. I started to get the sense that he was hunting for the Monkey King.
Yeah. Well, all these confluence of events that he's predicted basically lead him to meeting Abby.
Right.
Yeah.
Which and, and then in the next issue, we find out Abby's realized that something's not right, that something's going on at this school. There's something, you know, terrorizing the kids. So, of course, she runs to the swamp and... He already knows, so they go back to the home and confront.
That's a great, great scene, by the way. Whenever they get to the home, and they both realize that it's too late. They can just feel that shit has hit the fan, and they're too late.
Yeah, whatever happens, all the kids are terrorized, and they're just their fear just keeps growing and growing, and growing.
The one with the girl that had been sexually abused by her father. Oh, that was
At the same time, Matt's insecurities are growing, and he's becoming more and more sort of angry about Abigail and why she's not at home and why she doesn't perform sexually for him and all this other stuff. But
she's eating tubers, dude.
She's eating tubers. Why does your breath smell like tuber again?
Why do you smell like tuber? Let me smell your breath.
And by the end of this issue, the Monkey King has sort of engrossed himself with so much fear that he's become extremely powerful now.
Mm-hmm.
And the Swamp Thing confronts him, but so does another character at the end of this issue, which is now we see the demon. And in this end of this issue and the next issue, I think is some of the best demon speak I've ever read.
Oh.
Just fantastic poetry, you know, because he speaks in rhyme. And
Alan Moore writing Etrigan dialogue.
Yeah, it's just phenomenal. I never really care for the demon all that much, but having Alan Moore write him, I could certainly.
Most people can't write the fucking rhyming shit.
Yeah, because they just go to like really basic like nursery rhyme kind of stuff, and he's like
someone so literary.
Yeah, he's doing a phenomenal.
I'll quote Vince. That is sex on paper.
Yes, it was
really good.
And then we have Matt gets in a car accident because he's drinking and he decides he's going to go try and help Abby. He gets in a car accident and he's trapped in this car, which leads to the Monkey King reaching out to him and his fear because he's this great amount of fear because he's afraid he's going to die in this car. At the same time, the demon and Swamp Thing are fighting the Monkey King, and he's trying to. I didn't quite understand what he was trying to do with Matt. Was it because Matt has these powers himself, and he's trying to pull that in, or was it just the fear?
It may be that the Monkey
King was looking for a new master.
Well, I was thinking that he knew that they were onto him, and so he may have been
trying
looking
to
for a new master,
master move on to something else. That makes sense. And then basically what happens is Paul is the one that turns the tables on the Monkey King and is sick of being afraid and decides that he's not going to be afraid of him anymore. And that takes away his power and shrinks him down to a little tiny bug, which Etrigan eats. Which is just awesome.
Tastes like chicken.
And we also find out a little bit more about Swamp Thing's abilities. He gets his arm chopped off by the demon. He just puts it back on. And you can't seem to hurt him or anything. This story was much more to me, just more of a straightforward sort of action, you know,
horror
action story. He wasn't trying to do anything too fancy with it. While, you know, he certainly played on some stuff and built in a little bit more to the mythology. It seemed like he was just having fun with this, you know, bringing the demon in and all that and just moving the Swamp Thing forward. And now he can just tell stories like this, and you don't have to do all that other stuff because it's, you know, he already took care of it. Some more walking in the swamp with Paul and Swamp Thing, and we find out, you know, Jason Blood and the demon are the same character, which at this point I still didn't know because they still didn't say that.
Oh, that's right.
Until the very end.
Didn't seem to transform. He was just there.
Yeah. Like I said, Matt and the Monkey King went after Matt to try and sort of connect with him. And I don't know exactly what happened, but at the end of the issue, Matt pulls up in his car and there's nothing wrong with it. And he's fine. And he picks up Abigail and they drive.
He was fucked up in that car.
Teeth missing, bleeding all over the place, internal bleeding. He was going to die. And now he's fine. And he picks Abigail up and drives off. So,
suspicious.
Yeah, I don't know what.
We'll see what happens next.
That is the end.
And that's the recap. That's sort of the recap of it. But
so now let's talk about it.
We didn't really talk about it. Sorry, I don't know.
No, it's I loved it.
I really enjoyed it a lot. It was certainly. Certainly a little different Alan Moore. I mean, obviously, this is really early stuff of his. While I thought it was, you know, really well done, it's not the same kind of thing of, like, you know, Watchmen or, you know, V for Vendetta or his more intricate sort of work. This is a bit simpler. But at the same time, I think, you know, in 1982, I don't think, was there anything else like this in mainstream comics? Anything even close to that at that time? I can't imagine that there was really.
I mean, what's great about it is that it's kind of like equal parts classic EC comics and old Hitchcock films.
Yeah.
And 1980s like slasher films. You know, a little bit of that, but then it's also Alan Moore's kind of, you know, high concept work of, you know, talking about, you know, man and nature and you know, with the whole thing with the kids and fear and how fear manifests. So it's got some great high concept stuff, but it's a horror book, but it's just done.
Horror by Moore.
Yeah.
No, absolutely, and I thought it's very unique work because, you know, to take a character that is, you know, sort of a cheesy superhero at one point in the Marvel or in the DC universe and turn it into so much more than that and so much more interesting of a character and in just a completely different sort of vein of anything that was going on, I just thought was, you know. Like I said, when we first started, it was just ballsy by a guy that hadn't done anything in American comics to that point. And, you know, how old would he have been at that point?
He was probably in his 20s, probably.
You know, it's just... I mean, you can see why.
And did this officially...
He's talented.
He's fucking talented. He's a talented writer.
Did this officially become the first subpar movie based on an Alan Moore work?
Well, I think the movie was made...
Before, wasn't it? Was it based on Alan Moore stuff?
I don't know. I think it was based on
the first...
The first, on the one
Ween,
yeah.
Still, it still sucked. It still sucked in comparison.
Adrian... Was it Adrian...
Yeah.
Barbeau,
yeah.
With her big tits.
I, you know, I, I liked a lot of Bissett and Tadelbaum's work. The art is not the draw for me on this book. I would have loved to have seen Alan Moore work with Bernie Wrightson on that for a while.
I thought Bissett did some amazing stuff with Swamp Thing, and obviously he was much more interested in drawing, seemed like he was much more interested in
face.
Yeah, not so much. But at the same time, I think if you look at some of the panel layouts and stuff that he did, it was pretty original, pretty interesting. A lot of that stuff, I don't know, if Wrightson would have really taken those chances necessarily.
It'd be interesting to see if Alan Moore, who was kind of famous or infamous for his incredibly detailed scripts, if a guy like Wrightson would take a script like that and go, who the fuck do you think you are?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, who knows if at that time he was writing scripts I don't know, but it was only four or five years later. I went back and forth on it as far as art. Really, I said I thought there was some stuff that was awesome, but yeah, there was a lot of there's a lot of stuff that was kind of meh. It was okay.
It's serviceable for the story. But
and
then,
I think you saw a lot. I think you saw a lot of that at that time too. Of some of the is Bissett British?
I have no idea.
Because it seems like it wouldn't surprise me either, especially the style, because there was a lot of that stuff from like the British, artist that kind of was a little experimental, but at the same time, kind of weak on the basics.
Do you think this was kind of DC's first experiment with bringing some British talent over from like the Marvel UK offices? I don't know if they had worked with many Brits before this. I have no idea.
I'm trying to remember
it might have been the first. Marvel hadn't done it.
Yeah, Marvel hadn't done it. Yeah. And I think Moore really was the first guy to come over, and his success.
I'm sure someone will get pissed.
They had, like the Filipino artists in the 70s on, like House of Mystery and that kind of stuff. But I didn't know if any of the British invasion.
Look at it this way, too. It's like we look at Alan Moore now and it's like, oh, legendary writer.
Oh, yeah.
They put him on a book that, quite honestly, nobody probably gave a shit about at the time. Yeah, what I mean? So it's like he just happened to turn it into something that.
Boy, and how long did he go on that book? It was a long run.
It says in the back here he ran from 83 to 87.
He did like 50 issues.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, and then
you got Rick Veitch, Dan Day later on, which I'm super excited to.
Mark Miller.
To read the rest of it. I mean, I can't wait till the next one comes out, because I really enjoyed this a lot.
That book...
Josh Dicer, as we said, Swamp Thing ruins your career.
Yeah.
You write Swamp Thing, it'll be the worst thing.
The worst thing you ever did.
Yeah. It's. I mean, people have been trying to live up to this run on Swamp Thing, and,
Yeah, so. I mean, I'm interested in seeing the... There is a Crisis on Infinite Earths issue.
Oh, is there?
Yeah.
Oh, man. That's so weird.
Everyone in the satellite, Swamp Thing's one of the characters, but the Alan Moore issue is he like wanders off and he's like, I don't know why I'm here. And John Constantine is there and he's like, well, there's something you have to do very specifically that's important for you to do, like in the grand scheme of things. And Swamp Thing goes off and
creates
that.
The Vertigo universe.
But the thing is, it isn't just the JLA that we see in future issues. We get all the magical characters show up, like Dr. Fate, like pretty much when it was still a DC book, Moore wasn't afraid to
mix it. Yeah.
Lots of DC characters.
That's awesome,
get involved in the Swamp Thing stories. There's a great DC Comics Presents annual, the Superman team-up title, which is Superman and Swamp Thing, where Alan Moore wrote, and Superman gets infected with like a red moss from Krypton, and Swamp Thing has to help cure him. And it's pretty cool. Hunt it down on the DC. I hope they
keep coming out with these.
Well, they said it says on the back of this that they're going to the entire collection of Alan Moore's run on it is going to be in hardcover. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to the next one. Like I said, I had never read this before. I really had never had any interest in the character. I'd always heard a lot about it, but I was like, really? It's a fucking plant guy running around? How boring could
that
be?
That Man-Thing.
Man-Thing. I've never read a Man-Thing issue ever.
And Gerber did some amazing stuff with Man-Thing.
But Moore's just, I mean, he really is just phenomenal. He's look on, his look into stuff, you know, his perspective.
He could make Toast interesting. Yeah. Toast Man. Oh, yeah. Okay, I can do that.
There was a Toast Man, I think. Well, wasn't there a Toast Man?
If Alan Moore wrote it,
I don't think he wrote it, but no, it's an awesome. It's certainly not my favorite Alan Moore work, but it's good. I mean, it's certainly better than a lot of stuff that's
out
there.
It's in the team picture.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that I waited to read it because there's no way,
I just love his versatility. You guys just on League of Nobodies did Tom Strong.
And yeah,
it's like the guy that wrote Tom Strong wrote this.
Yeah,
I love his versatility.
He can write. He's just a purely good writer.
Yeah,
and that's why he's the best comic writer ever. He can write anything, and he writes it all good, and it's all entertaining. And
he made Wildcats good.
Yes, he did.
Yeah. He did make Wildcats.
Yeah.
Are we done with this one?
Yes.
That's probably enough.
All right. Well, Sal, thank you.
I seem like I just talked the whole time. You guys, let me just ramble.
It was your pick.
I didn't want to,
I tried to stop you when I could.
You can hope to contain me, Tom. I can't stop me.
Stop you.
You can't hope to contain me.
Thank you. It was a good
You're
pick.
A fucking force of nature.
I had actually picked it up whenever it first came out, and it had been sitting. It had been sitting on my bookshelves, and I was like, I need to read that. And so I was actually really happy whenever you picked that.
Oh, I do want to ask Tom, because you've read way beyond this collection in Swamp Thing, right? Does Swamp Thing become much more of sort of like a force of nature, more of a sort of a... Because I remember reading like a Hellblazer issue with Swamp Thing in it, and at that point he was like this plant... God or like demigod almost. He was almost sort of like,
yeah.
He could travel like through the green and stuff like that, and just
he even goes into outer space later.
Really?
Yeah.
I can't wait to read more of it.
Yeah, it's cool. All right. Cool. Well, Sal, thanks for picking that.
Sure.
And, thanks once again to In Stock Trades.
What's your pick, Chris?
Enough fucking around. Enough rambling.
We have picked a 600-page autobiography.
Yes.
We have picked a deeply, deeply complicated, intense, and fun book in The Adventures of Luther Arkwright.
Yeah. Wasn't that complicated?
Yes, it was. It was very fucking complicated. The radio play was great. I still got to get you that on CD. And now Alan Moore's Swamp Thing. So I'm going for a little bit of lighter fare.
Owly.
No, I wanted
Legion of Super Friends.
It is something I have been wanting to read for a long time, and and I was like, you know what? This is a perfect opportunity.
Dexter's Laboratory,
and it'll be a lot of fun. Our next book club selection is Justice League International Volume 1.
Oh, well, that's good. I have the hardcovers.
So I have the issues.
Yeah. I think I have the issues too. Yeah.
So I have always wanted to read the JLI.
You've never read
JLI. I've read it. Yeah. So yeah, it's been a long time since I read it when it first came out.
But I've always heard of the Bwahaha
era
Justice League, and we talked a little bit about Checkmate last week, and so
this is nothing like Checkmate.
Well, no, I've always wanted to know about the origins of Max Lord, and so
a different kind of Max Lord,
and
Booster and Beetle.
Well, I mean, that's the whole thing, is that Max Lord was always a joke.
How many issues does the first one go through?
The first seven, I believe.
I don't know if Booster shows up in the first seven. He doesn't show up until the sixth or seventh issue.
Yeah.
He
might not be in there.
I don't have it on me, but I know on the cover is
the second series or the second
volume
is probably.
I like the first one a lot.
I'm trying to remember.
The first one's when they have the the thing in the UN and Batman's in charge and he can't get anyone to do it. The first one's really good.
Yeah.
But the Booster and Beetle stuff probably doesn't really kick off till the second one. But the first one's awesome.
Yeah. Well, I did check on InStock, and there's some beautiful hardcover editions of those that have come out. Yes. I believe that the first volume hardcover may be out of print or unavailable, but it is out in trade paperback now. And you can get that trade paperback at InStock Trades for 47% off. They've been great about raising their discounts for us. And pick it up, $9.50. It's $9.
Kevin McGuire doing hardcover? A monthly book.
Hmm?
For the hardcover,
For the trade. The trade is $9.54, and it is Kevin McGuire art. And yeah. It is awesome. Giffen.
Dematteis.
So
it's funny.
Yep. So there you go. Funny. That's our next book club. So
cool.
I have a feeling that we might be able to get through that one fairly quickly. It's seven issues.
Yeah. There's quick reads. Yeah. There's not a whole lot of delving into jail. Tom might be able to.
I'm gonna be interested in what you think of it.
Me?
Because considering you've never read it.
Never read. Yeah. As we sit here at an hour and 12 minutes, I don't know if the JLI will be an in depth.
Might be a 20-minute episode.
It might be a 20-minute episode. But I've always heard great stuff about it. There's a lot of love for that series.
I'm sort of interested because I haven't read it in years, so I'm kind of interested to how it'll read the second time around.
Yeah, we'll see, because that's when did that come out, Tom?
87.
Okay, so it might date a little bit, but
it's aged in that way, like, oh, this is old fashioned. I think it's aged in that DC remarkably treated their lead franchise in an extremely different way than they treated their good for them.
It's not insanely different. It's not the serious comics that you see today, not the serious,
but it there's adventure in it.
There's not just like gag, you know, there's plenty of gags, but
it's a little different. It's different, and I think it's almost still ahead.
A little ahead of the curve.
Think people don't.
I loved it when it came out, man. I absolutely loved it.
It was so completely different. Like mine, it was so just different fun from everything else that people were doing.
It was funny
and smart.
Yeah.
Smart. Yeah.
Well, good. I picked a good one.
Yeah.
All right.
Absolutely.
Cool. So check that out at InStock Trades. Hope you enjoyed our talk on Swamp Thing. Thanks again, Sal.
No problem.
And this is coming out at the end of the week. Come back on Monday for a regular, actually it's not even
road
a
trip. Road trip. It's a road trip.
It's the road trip. So we got a couple
if
oddball,
we live if we, through the night.
If we live to see Chicago again from our trip to Milwaukee.
Yeah.
So road trip episode coming out on Monday, and then more weird oddball episodes after that.
Who knows?
It is a summer of fun here at Around Comics. So check out aroundcomics.com, the community section, and all that good stuff. And we will talk to you on Monday.
Good night.
In the meantime,
and in between time,
we'll be
everywhere again. Was like recording a second episode.
Yeah, it was. It took a long time. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to ramble on. I didn't know how to. I didn't know. I wasn't here for the I wasn't sure what you guys wanted to, how you wanted to.
It was good.
I don't know. I just kept talking. Nobody said anything.
All right.
Yeah. In between
time.
Whatever.
Around Comics.
Around Comics.
All right. Views expressed in the interviews or by guests of the show are solely those of the individuals expressing them and may not reflect the opinions of Around Comics. Any reproduction, rebroadcast, or retransmission without the express written consent of Around Comics is strictly prohibited. All content presented in this program is the sole property of Around Comics, and this has been an Around Comics production, copyright 2009.